أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم تسليما كثيرا. We're at the third constant of jihad. الجهاد ليس معلقا بأرض. Jihad is not dependent on a particular land. The author says, بعد أن سقنا الأدلة في الحلقتين السابقتين التي تؤكد أن شعيرة الجهاد صالحة لكل زمان وأنه لا يوجد زمن من الأزمنة منذ أن شرع الله الجهاد لنبيه محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم إلى قيام الساعة من راية للجهاد في سبيل الله، من المناسب أن نسوق في هذه الحلقة الأدلة التي تثبت أن الجهاد ليس معلقا بأرض دون أخرى إذا وجدت الأسباب وانتفت الموانع. After we brought forth the evidence to prove that the ibadah of jihad is appropriate for every time and age, from the time of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam until the day of judgment, we will now bring evidence to prove that jihad is not dependent on a particular piece of land. He says, إن من المفاهيم الخاطئة والتي تسببت بتحريف مفهوم تلك الشعيرة هو أن تعلق عبادة الجهاد بأرض بعينها، وحينما تفقد تلك الأرض أو يحل الدمار بها فإن ذلك الفهم حتما سيؤدي إلى إلغاء هذه العبادة أو العزوف عنها أو الزعم بأن وقتها لم يحن بعد. So one of the false beliefs out there is that jihad is attached to some particular lands. If you want jihad, then you have to go to this particular area. And this would lead to the discontinuity of jihad if jihad stops in those places. Because why? We have attached jihad to the land. So if the land ceases to be a front, then people would think that that's it, jihad is over. وَلَا بُدَّ قَبْلَ الشُّرُوعِ فِي عِبَادَةِ الْجِهَادِ أَن نُرَسِّخَ مَفْهُومًا عَظِيمًا لِمُمَارَسَةِ هَذِهِ الشَّعِيرَ وَهُوَ أَنَّ الْجِهَادَ عَالَمِيٌّ لَا تَحْجِبُهُ الْحُدُودُ وَلَا الْحَوَاجِزُ. He said, so we have to establish an important principle, and that is jihad is global. Jihad is not a local phenomenon. Jihad is global. And jihad is not stopped by borders or barriers. Neither do borders nor barriers stand in the way of jihad fi sabilillah. Jihad doesn't recognize borders that were drawn by some colonial countries in the past that are drawn by a ruler on a map and then Muslims are supposed to abide by them. Jihad doesn't recognize those superficial borders. Jihad is global. وَأَنَّ الْمُسْلِمَ بِحَاجَةٍ إِلَى هَذِهِ الْعِبَادَةِ إِذَا كَانَ مُصَرًّا عَلَى تَبْلِيغِ دِينِ اللَّهِ تَعَالَى وَتَعْبِيدِ النَّاسِ لِرَبِّهِمْ. And a Muslim is in need of the ibadah of jihad if he wants to convey the message of Allah. If a Muslim wants to convey the religion of Allah Azza wa Jal, he needs jihad fi sabilillah. You cannot convey the message of Allah Azza wa Jal without jihad fi sabilillah. And that was the understanding of the Sahaba. The author says, كما فعل الصحابة رضي الله عنهم حينما كانوا يجوبون مشارق الأرض ومغاربها برسالة عبر عنها. ربعي بن عامر رضي الله عنه عندما سأله رستم ما جاء بكم فقال الله ابتعثنا والله جاء بنا لنخرج من شاء من عبادة العباد إلى عبادة الله ومن ضيق الدنيا إلى سعتها ومن جور الأديان إلى عدل الإسلام. He said, and that was the understanding of the Sahaba رضي الله عنهم, and that understanding is manifest in the letter of Rabi'i ibn Amr to Rustum, the leader of the Persians. Rabi'i ibn Amr was one of the Sahaba. He was sent as a messenger to meet with the Persian general. So Rustum asked Rabi'i, why did you come to our land? What brought you here? The Muslims entered into the land of Persia. Why did you come here? What's the reason? Is it for the sake of money, for the sake of expansion, for the sake of revenge? Why are you here? So Rabi'i ibn Amr summarized the objective of offensive jihad fi sabilillah. He said, Allah has sent us. It was Allah who brought us here, first of all. Allah has sent us so that we would deliver whom He wills from being servants of the servants of Allah to being servants of Allah. People are now worshipping the servants of Allah Azza wa Jal, and they're worshipping creation of Allah Azza wa Jal. They're worshipping people, they're worshipping stones, they're worshipping animals. So they're worshipping the creation of Allah. So Rabi'ah ibn Amr is saying that we came here to save you. We came here to deliver whom Allah wills, because we don't control who becomes Muslim. إِنَّكَ لَا تَهْدِي مَنْ أَحْبَبْتُ وَلَكِنَّ اللَّهَ يَهْدِي مَنْ يَشَاءُ. Allah Azza wa Jalla is telling Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam that hidayah is not in your hands, it is Allah who guides. So Rabi'ah is saying that we would deliver whom Allah wills from being servants of the creation of Allah to being servants of Allah. And from the narrowness of this life to the broadness of this life and the afterlife. So you're living a narrow life in dunya. If you're not a Muslim, you have tunnel vision. You're living a narrow life. Your worldview is limited. But with Islam, it would give you the broad perspective. It would put things in perspective. It would let you know the real meaning of what this dunya is. See, anybody without Islam is living in darkness. They're living in a tunnel. They cannot see. But a Muslim with Qur'an, for example, let's look at the perspective that Qur'an gives you. Qur'an talks about the history since Adam alayhi salam until Muhammad sallallahu alayhi salam. And then it talks about the future, about death and what would happen beyond death. So it gives you a time frame of everything that occurred in the world since Adam alayhi salam, and it will tell you what will happen in the future. What other book can provide you with such a perspective? People are living their particular moment, the particular age that they're living in. But a Muslim feels that he's part of a caravan that started with Adam alayhi salam and will end with Isa alayhi salam. You're part of something. You have a heritage. You have a history. You're part of the Ahl al-Haqq, the people of truth. You are part of the Anbiya, and that's why Allah Azza wa Jalla says in Surah Al-Anbiya, after Allah Azza wa Jalla told us the story of the prophets, the last ayah was, إِنَّ هَذِهِ أُمَّتُكُمْ أُمَّةً وَاحِدَةً وَأَنَا رَبُّكُمْ فَعَبَدُونَ. This is your ummah, and it's one ummah. So there's no difference between the ummah of Isa, and the ummah of Musa, and the ummah of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and the ummah of Nuh. They're all part of the same ummah. We're talking about the true followers of Musa, and the true followers of Isa alayhi salam, obviously. إِنَّ هَذِهِ أُمَّتُكُمْ أُمَّةً وَاحِدَةً وَأَنَا رَبُّكُمْ فَعَبَدُونَ. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, when he went to Medina, and he found that the Jews were fasting the 10th of Muharram. Rasulullah said, why did they fast this day? They said, because this is the day in which Allah has saved Musa alayhi salam from Fir'aun. Rasulullah said, نَحْنُ أَوْلَ أَحَقُّ بِمُوسَى مِنْهُمْ. Musa belongs to us more than he belongs to them. So this should be a ibadah for us. And Rasulullah started fasting the 10th of Muharram. So a Muslim has the broad perspective. He's living in light while everybody else is living in darkness. And then he said, وَمِنْ جَوْرِ الْأَدْيَانِ إِلَىٰ عَدْلِ الْإِسْلَامِ. And from the oppression of religions to the justice of Islam. So Rabi'i was telling him that all religions would have you live in oppression. Only Islam will give you justice. Ibn Ayyub Amr, he was not a student of religions. He didn't study comparative religion. Probably he doesn't know much about the Zoroastrian religion or the Jewish religion or the Christian religion. But he has yaqeen. And he knows that Islam is the true religion. So he said that religions, adyan, plural, will offer you oppression. And Islam will offer you justice. And then he said, فَأَرْسَلَنَا بِدِينِهِ إِلَىٰ خَلْقِهِ لِنَدْعُوَهُمْ إِلَيْهِ. So he sent us with his religion to invite the people to Islam. So Rabi'ah ibn Amr is saying that we are carrying these swords for the sake of da'wah. فَمَنْ قَبِلَ مِنَّا ذَلِكَ قَبِلْنَا ذَلِكَ مِنْهُ وَرَجَعْنَا عَنْهُ وَتَرَكْنَاهُ وَأَرْضَهُ يَلِيَهَ دُونَنَا. And if you accept Islam, then we will leave. And we will leave you in charge of this land. وَمَنْ أَبَى قَاتَلْنَاهُ أَبَدًا حَتَّى نُفْضِيَ إِلَى مَوْعُودُ اللَّهِ. And whoever refuses our invitation, then we will fight him until we reach to the promise of Allah. Rustam said, what is the promise of Allah? He said, الْجَنَّةُ لِمَنْ مَاتَ عَلَىٰ قِتَالٍ قِتَالِ مَنْ أَبَىٰ وَالظَّفَرُ لِمَنْ بَقِيٍ. He said, Jannah for the ones who are killed, and victory for the ones who are alive. This is the promise of Allah. إِحْدَى الْحُسْنَيْنِ. So you can never lose. If you're killed, then you're a shaheed. If you live, then you are victorious. This message of Rabi'i ibn Amr is important because it shows us what the Sahaba understood the purpose of the jihad was. We're here for da'wah. Obviously, we're talking about here the jihad of expansion, the jihad which is the offensive jihad, which is different in its objectives than jihad al-daf'. In the jihad of defense, your purpose is not da'wah. You're fighting an enemy because he came and took over your land. So this is an important difference. It is in the offensive jihad, that is when your objective is da'wah, not in the defensive jihad. Because some people say, well, why are you treating the occupiers so brutally? Shouldn't we give them da'wah? Now, he came to our land, he should be treated brutally. You give him da'wah in his land. He came here with the strength of his army, therefore the treatment should be equivalent. You give them invitation of da'wah when you are in their land. But when an enemy attacks your land, you do not have to give them the da'wah. You immediately attack. Because you are fighting for the defense of Muslims, which is more important in the eyes of Allah Azza wa Jalla than da'wah. The defense of Muslims and their land and the honor of Islam is more important than inviting someone in. Because, as Ibn Taymiyyah says, protecting the capital takes precedence over protecting the Prophet. I mean, your capital is the Muslims. And the profit that you can make on that is the da'wah. So protecting the capital is more important than making profit or protecting your profit. فَالصَّحَابَةُ جَاءُوا بِالسَّيْفِ وَالْقُرْآنِ لِيَفْتَحُوا بِقَاعَ الْأَرْضِ وَبِمَا أَنَّ الْمُسْلِمَ لَا زَالَ يَحْمِلُ الرِّسَالَةَ الْمُحَمَّدِيَةَ فَلَا بُدَّ لَهُ أَنْ يَحْمِلَ مَفْهُومَ أَنَّ الْجِهَادَ صَالِحٌ لِكُلِّ زَمَانٍ وَلِكُلِّ مَكَانٍ. Any Muslim who still believes in Islam and wants to invite people to Islam needs to also believe that jihad is appropriate for every time and age. And then he says, وَقَوْلُنَا صَالِحٌ لِكُلِّ مَكَانٍ لَا يَعْنِي أَنَّ الْمُسْلِمَ لَيْسَ لَهُ هَمٌّ إِلَّا أَنْ يُشْعِلَ الْحُرُوبَ فِي كُلِّ بِقَاعِ الْأَرْضِ. He said, saying that a Muslim believes that jihad is appropriate for every time and age does not mean that a Muslim is eager to go around and ignite wars all over the world, sort of to say trigger happy. No, he said, no, that's not the case. It's not the case that Muslims want war to erupt all over the world. He said, كَلَّا وَلَكِنَّ الْجِهَادَ صَالِحٌ لِكُلِّ مَكَانٍ تَوَفَّرَتْ فِيهِ الشُّرُوطُ وَانْتَفَتْ فِيهِ الْمَوَانَةِ. We say, no, jihad is appropriate in every age and time when the conditions and prerequisites exist. So there are some rules that govern jihad fi sabilillah. It's not that Muslims want to fight all over the world and just start fitna everywhere and fight in every piece of land they can. That's not the case. There are rules that govern jihad fi sabilillah. And he said that this is not the place to talk about these rules because it needs an independent research. المهم القول أن القناعة بأن الجهاد ماض إلى قيام الساعة وأنه موجود في كل زمان وهذا موضوع الحلقة الأولى تجرنا هذه القناعة حتما إلى التأكد بأن الجهاد موجود في أرض أو أكثر من بلاد العالم اليوم ومعنى ذلك هو أن الجهاد لا يعلق بأرض بل هو معلق بشروط سواء كانت تلك الشروط هي أسباب تشريع أو كانت مقومات عمل. He said it's important to have iman that jihad will carry on until the day of judgment, and we talked about that in the first principle, and that it exists in every time. And he said that this would lead us to conclude that today there is jihad somewhere on the face of the earth. Definitely there will be jihad in some part of the earth. ومعنى ذلك هو أن الجهاد لا يعلق بأرض بل هو معلق بشروط. So, and then he said that there are conditions for fighting jihad في سبيل الله. These conditions are either sharia conditions or strategic conditions. There are two types of conditions for fighting jihad في سبيل الله. And then he says, والانطلاق من هذا المفهوم لممارسة شعيرة الجهاد يجعل العبد حرا في تطبيقه لهذه العبادة فهو غير محصور بأرض ولم يعلق الجهاد ببلد. He said, having this understanding will make you free in practicing the ibadah of jihad fi sabilillah because you don't attach it to a particular land. And this is a problem, and probably an example would need to be given to comprehend what he means by this. And some people say that jihad today is in this particular land, so you have to travel all the way to that land to fight jihad fi sabilillah. And people would restrict it to this particular area. For example, we all agree that the Jews have occupied Palestine and changed its identity from being Muslim to being Jewish, and they even gave it a new name, and that is Israel. So people will say that to fight the Israelis, you have to go to Palestine and fight them. But it's not allowed for you to target them anywhere else on the face of the earth. Now this is absolutely false. It doesn't stand on any Sharia foundation. Who said that if a particular people are in a state of war with you, that this war needs to be limited to the piece of land that they occupied? If a particular nation or people are classified as Ahl Harb in the Sharia, then that applies to them on the whole earth. It is not restricted to a particular area. ويتضح ما تقدم من مطالعة السيرة فالمسلمون خسروا في بداية الإسلام ديارهم وأرضهم وأموالهم ولكنهم لم يعتقدوا أن الإسلام لن ينتشر إلا من تلك الأرض المقدسة مكة بسبب ما فيها من مقومات حيث أنها كانت قبلة العرب آنذاك وهي ثقلهم وهي البلد التي يعرفونها ويعرفون أهلها. He said that the Muslims started out in Mecca and they left Mecca, and they didn't say that since Mecca is the holy land, then we have to fight in the holy land, and we cannot fight except from that place. No. Rasulullah ﷺ left from Mecca and established a base in Medina and started fighting jihad fi sabilillah from Medina. فكان النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم يخيل إليه بأنه مهاجر وكان يذهب ظنه إلى اليمامة. So Rasulullah صلى الله عليه وسلم made hijrah and he went to Medina. And then the author says, وانتشر الإسلام من أرض ليست هي أحب البقاع لا إلى الله ولا إلى نبيه. He said that Islam spread from a place that wasn't the most beloved to Allah and it wasn't the most beloved to Rasulullah صلى الله عليه وسلم. Because we know that Rasulullah صلى الله عليه وسلم, when he left from Mecca, he looked back and he said, أنت أحب البلاد إلى الله وأنت أحب البلاد إلي ولولا المشركين أهلك أخرجوني لما خرجت منك. Rasulullah صلى الله عليه وسلم looked back to Mecca and said, you are the most beloved land to Allah, and you are the most beloved land to me, and if it wasn't for the mushrikeen driving me out, I wouldn't have left you. So Rasulullah ﷺ left Mecca, and it was the most beloved land to him and to Allah Azza wa Jal, and he established base in Medina, and he spread Islam from Medina, not from Mecca. So the spread of Islam was from a place that wasn't the most beloved. So the author says, Rasulullah ﷺ did not customize Islam based on his location. No, he customized the location based on Islam. So Rasulullah ﷺ was not looking for an Islam that is appropriate for Mecca. No, he was looking for a location that would be appropriate for Islam. And this is contrary to the logic of many Muslims today. Many Muslims today, they say that since we're living in the West, we have to customize an Islam that is suitable for the West. No, that's not how you should practice Islam. If you feel that Islam needs to be customized for a particular area, that means you need to make hijrah from it and go and find a place where you don't have to customize your Islam, where you can live Islam in its entirety. So Rasulullah ﷺ could have stayed in Mecca and said that because of the conditions in Mecca, in order to live with the people and give them da'wah and be a good citizen, I should do this and that, and I should stop preaching extremism, and I should stop talking ill about their gods, and I should do this and that in order to make the people love Islam. No, Rasulullah ﷺ didn't do that. He told them, this is Islam, this is the message of Allah Azza wa Jal. I have no control over it, I cannot change it, and I have to convey it. And Allah Azza wa Jal told me, oh Muhammad, if you don't convey everything that I sent down with you, you have not conveyed my message. Allah has told Muhammad ﷺ in the Quran that if you hold back anything that was revealed to you, then you have not conveyed the message. And Rasulullah ﷺ went around in search of people who will accept Islam as it is. And when he found a tribe that was willing to give him nusra, he found a tribe that was willing to give him support. But they had one condition. They said, when you die, you appoint us to be kings after you. Only this condition made Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam turn down the deal. He said, the earth belongs to Allah and Allah will appoint who He wills. I cannot appoint one of you, I cannot promise any of you anything. Another tribe, they said, we agree. We will offer you protection, but we will offer you protection from the direction of the Arabs, not the direction of the Persians, because they were living on the borders between the Arab land and the Persian Empire. So they said that we can provide you support from any attack from the Arab side, but we cannot do that from the Persian side. Rasulullah ﷺ said, this religion cannot be carried except by someone who can surround it from each side. You cannot be the bearers of this message, the carriers of this message, if you're willing to support it when it's easy and not willing to support it when it's tough and difficult. You have to either stand up for everything, the entire message, and protect it from every side. Otherwise, you have not taken up your responsibility. So Rasulullah ﷺ also turned down this offer. Until he found people from Medina who were willing to accept all of the terms of Rasulullah ﷺ. And then obviously, since this is an agreement, it's a deal, it's a transaction, they said, and what will we get in exchange? So they did ask, and they have the right to ask for that. They said, فَمَا لَنَا يَا رَسُولَ اللَّهِ If we fulfill your terms, what will you give us back? What did Rasulullah ﷺ say? He said, will I appoint you as members of my parliament? Or will I make you part of the government? Or will I appoint you as a khulafa after me? No. Or will I give you money in exchange for your service? He said, no. One word, al-jannah. That's what I can promise you, paradise. That's all. And the Ansar were very happy with that and they said, رَبِحَ الْبَيْعِ They said, this is a profitable trade, لَا نَقِيلُ وَلَا نَسْتَقِيلُ We will not back out of it. We'll stand up firm for it. And they did. So Rasulullah ﷺ was searching for a land that would accept his conditions. Now this is a serious problem, Muslims in the West trying to fabricate a fifth madhab that is suitable for the West. They're trying to change the usul al-fiqh so that it will be, if you change the usul of fiqh, then you can bring up a new fiqh. So the objective is to change fiqh by changing the usul of fiqh. Obviously many issues of aqidah are blacked out because they're too extreme to be presented in the West. And some of the ibadat are also eliminated. So it's customizing Islam based on the location. And this is a very, very dangerous trend. And obviously it's a trend that the West would love and would promote. وحمل الراية من بعد النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم أصحابه رضي الله عنهم ففعلوا كما فعل سيدهم صلى الله عليه وسلم فجابوا الأرض طولا وعرضا ولم يكن سبب مفارقتهم للمدينة النبوية فرارهم بدينهم كما فارقوا مكة بل إنهم فارقوا أقدس البقاع بعد مكة من أجل نشر الدين وإقامة شعيرة الجهاد في مشارق الأرض ومغاربها And then the Sahaba came after Rasulullah صلى الله عليه وسلم And they followed his tracks And they went around the world, east and west, spreading the religion of Allah Azza wa Jal. And the reason they left Medina now wasn't the same reason that made them leave Mecca, and that is to flee with their religion. No, the reason why they left Medina now is to spread the religion of Allah Azza wa Jal. So they left the holiest places, Mecca and Medina, for the sake of jihad fi sabilillah. يوضح ذلك ما رواه الإمام مالك في موطئه فقال إن أبا الدرداء رضي الله عنه كتب إلى سلمان الفارسي رضي الله عنه أن هلم إلى الأرض المقدسة إمام مالك narrates in his موطأ that Abu Darda sent a letter to his friend, his dear friend, they were very close, سلمان الفارسي. So Abu Darda sent a letter to سلمان الفارسي telling him, come to the Holy Land. This was the letter. He's inviting his brother to come to the Holy Land. Salman al-Farsi responded back by saying, إِنَّ الْأَرْضَ لَا تُقَدِّسُ أَحَدًا وَإِنَّمَا يُقَدِّسُ الْإِنسَانَ عَمَلَهُ The Holy Land doesn't make anyone holy. It is your deeds that make you holy. So you're inviting me to the Holy Land. Me coming to the Holy Land won't make me holy. It is my deeds that will make me holy. And that's why they left the Holy Land to fight في سبيل الله عز وجل. فلم يعلقوا الجهاد بمكة أو المدينة، ولم يعلقوه أيضا ببيت المقدس، بل إنهم جعلوا تلك الشعيرة عبادة يعبدون الله بها في كل مكان تحققت أسباب التعبد بها. So they didn't attach jihad to Mecca or Medina or Jerusalem, but they made this ibadah that can be practiced anywhere in the earth if the conditions are fulfilled, if the conditions exist. ولو أن المسلمين علقوا الجهاد بالأرض لاندثرت تلك الشعيرة، لأن المسلمين فقدوا السيطرة على بقاع عدة في تاريخهم القديم والمعاصر. فتعليق مفهوم الجهاد من أجل بيت المقدس يؤدي إلى زوال الشعيرة إذا عجز المسلمون عن تحريرها أو حرروها. He said, if Muslims say that our jihad is for the sake of this particular place, then this would lead to the end of jihad. And he gives an example. If the Muslims say that we are fighting to free Jerusalem, then this could lead to the end of jihad if we fail to free Jerusalem or if it's freed. Because if we free Jerusalem, we'll say that's it. We don't have a quarrel with the Yahud anymore. It's over with. And if we fail to free it, then we'll also say there's no use of jihad fi sabilillah because it's a lost cause. And then he says, وَهَذَا يَدُلُّ دَلَالَةً وَاضَحَةً عَلَى ضَلَالِ مَنْ قَالَ إن نزاعنا مع اليهود هو نزاع من أجل الأرض فقد كذب ذلك القائل بل إن نزاعنا مع اليهود هو نزاع عقائدي. He said, and this shows you the falsehood of the claim that our conflict with the Jews is a conflict based on land. He said, that's a lie. Our conflict with the Jews is based on religion. And then he says, ولو أن المسلمين استنقذوا جميع بلاد المسلمين من أيديهم لكان واجبا عليهم أيضا أن يلاحقوهم في أرضهم ويغزوهم في عقر دارهم كما فعل النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم وأصحابه من بعده. He said, so if the Muslims free Palestine from the hands of the Jews, it is still a duty on the Muslims to pursue the Yahud and follow them all over the world, as Rasulullah صلى الله عليه وسلم did by invading their own lands. ومفهوم تعليق الجهاد بأرض هو مفهوم باطل سيؤدي إلى التخلي عن تلك الشعيرة إذا فقدت تلك الأرض، وهذا نفسه قد يؤدي إلى إلغاء شعائر أخرى إذا ما أنيطت بأسباب لم يأذن الله لها. So he reiterates the point that attaching jihad to a particular land would lead to the end of jihad fi sabilillah. So this is the third principle or constant of jihad fi sabilillah. The fourth one is quite similar. الجهاد ليس معلقا بمعركة. Jihad is not dependent on a battle, on a particular battle. ومن الآفات التي تنخر في عقيدة كثير من الناس تجاه الجهاد هو تعليق شعيرة الجهاد بمعركة. فإن انتصرنا في تلك المعركة فهذا يدل على صحة ذلك المبدأ والمقدمة، وإن هزمنا فهذا يدل على بطلان المقدمة والمبدأ، وهذا الاعتقاد باطل شرعا وعقلا وهو ناتج عن الانهزامية وقلة الإيمان وعدم الصبر والمصابرة. The author says, another problem that people have in their understanding of jihad fi sabilillah is that if we win in this particular battle, then we were right in fighting jihad. If we lose in that battle, then we were wrong in fighting jihad. And we would find that he reiterates this point in more than one principle because it is a serious problem. People base their perception on jihad on the results. So if a particular group of mujahideen win, then they're on the right path. If they lose, then they're on the false path and they shouldn't be fighting jihad fi sabilillah. And this is a false perception. And then he says, أما شرعا فإن النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم كما جاء في الصحيحين قال عرضت علي الأمم فجعل النبي والنبيان يمرون معهم الرهط وليس والنبي وليس معه أحد. He mentions the hadith that on the day of judgment Rasulullah صلى الله عليه وسلم saw some anbiya without any followers. So does this mean that the Nabi failed? No. He did his job. He fulfilled his responsibility of da'wah, but nobody responded. The result was a failure, but that doesn't mean that the Nabi failed. Because hidayah is something in the hands of Allah Azza wa Jal. It's not in the hands of the anbiya. Can we say that Rasulullah صلى الله عليه وسلم failed in his da'wah to his uncle Abu Talib? No. He did his responsibility and more in his da'wah to his uncle Abu Talib. But the heart of his uncle is not in the hands of Rasulullah صلى الله عليه وسلم. It's in the hands of Allah. ولنا في التاريخ معارك كانت الهزيمة فيها يتصور معها المسلم أنها لن تقوم للإسلام بعدها قائمة. He said there were some points in our history when the Muslims were defeated in battles and the Muslims thought that we could never stand up on our feet again. these were critical battles in our history, and the Muslims thought that if we lose in this particular battle, that's the end of us. That's the end of Islam. He said, and the worst of these battles was the war with the Tatar in year 656 Hijri. عندما اجتاحوا بلاد العراق والشام فقتلوا في العراق في 40 يوما أكثر من مليون نسمة أي بمعدل 25 ألف نسمة يوميا. He said the Tatar, when they invaded al-Sham and al-Iraq and they entered Iraq, for 40 days they were killing people in Baghdad. They killed over a million in 40 days, an average of 25,000 a day of killing. Every day they would kill about 25,000. Over a period of 40 days they killed over a million. وزاد فسادهم واجتاحوا بلاد الإسلام. And they carried on and entered into the land of al-Sham. وانتصروا في كل معركة خاضوها ضد المسلمين. And they won every single battle they fought with the Muslims. Every single battle that the Tatar fought with the Muslims, they won. So people in that time would fall into a state of despair. These are an undefeatable people. We cannot win against them. And this is going to be the end of us. They've invaded the land of Khorasan, they invaded Persia, they invaded Iraq, and now they invaded al-Sham. And they're going to cross over to Egypt and North Africa, and that's the end. But what happened? ولما محص الله المسلمين وتضرعوا إليه التقى التتار مع المسلمين في معركة عين جالوت وهزموا شر هزيمة. He said, but Allah Azza wa Jalla, when He purified the Muslims through those trials, and they were sincere in their dua to Allah Azza wa Jalla and in their jihad, they defeated the Tatar in the battle of Ain Jalut, and it was a critical defeat of the Tatar, and it was a turning point. After that, it was a reversal of trends for a Tatar. Now, when the Muslims won against the Tatar, they didn't win at a moment of strength. They have already lost most of their land. So if you're going to argue from a logical point of view, you should say that the Muslims should have won in the beginning because their army was complete, their resources are all under their control. No, they lost in the beginning. And they only won when the number of Muslims was now few and the resources in their hands were also limited. So the issue of victory and defeat is not something that can be explained logically, and Muslims never win according based on their numbers or their resources. Victory is something that is a blessing from Allah Azza wa Jalla. It's a gift from Allah. And then he gives the example of the Qaramutah, which was also similar. فَتَعْلِيقُ شَعِيرَةِ الْجِهَادِ بِمَعْرَكَةٍ هُوَ مِنْ أَكْبَرِ عَوَامِ الْهَزِيمَ النَّسِيَّةِ وَمِنْ أَكْبَرِ عَوَامِ الْضَعْفِ الْمُسْلِمِينَ الْيَوْمِ لأننا لا في القديم ولا في الحديث لم نقاتل عدوا بكثرة عدد ولا عدة ولا يمكن أبدا أن نعول في معاركنا على موازين مادية فإذا بذلنا وسعنا في الإعداد فقد برئت الذمة حتى لو حصلت الهزيمة. So he said, we have to do our best in terms of preparation and then we fight. Then if we lose, we have done all what we are capable of and we have fulfilled our duty and fought jihad في سبيل الله as we should. In this case, we leave the results to Allah Azza wa Jal, whether we win or we lose. But he says that we have to prepare well. Preparation is essential. And this is becoming extremely important today, in a time when methods of combat have developed and became very complicated. Preparation is essential. So any Muslim who is serious and sincere in his will to fight jihad fi sabilillah needs to give time for preparation. And if a person fights jihad fi sabilillah and he didn't prepare, and the defeat was because of not preparing, then a Muslim is accountable for that. And if a Muslim doesn't prepare to fight jihad fi sabilillah, then a Muslim is committing a sin by doing that, because when jihad becomes fardain, preparation also becomes fardain. And if jihad is fard kifaya, then preparation would be fard kifaya. So the preparation takes the same ruling as the jihad. So if the jihad is fard ayn, preparation is fard ayn. If it's fard kifaya, then the preparation becomes fard kifaya. Yeah, we don't want brothers talking about jihad fi sabilillah, because jihad fi sabilillah is not talk. Then he says, وتعليق ارتفاع شأن الإسلام بمعركة بعينها أو بحرب خاصة قد يؤدي إلى الإحباط وترك الجهاد بسبب تلك الهزيمة علما أننا لا نقاتل بعدد ولا عدة فقد نكون في معركة أكثر من عدونا وأفضل مكانا منه إلا أننا لم نستكمل شروط النصر الإيمانية فيمحصنا الله بالهزيمة لتصفى النفوس وتتمحص الصفوف. He said that if we think that Islam depends on our victory in a particular battle, that is wrong, and that would lead to despair, and it would lead to discontinuity of jihad fi sabilillah. And then he says, we are not fighting based on our numbers or our preparation. We could be in a particular battle more than our enemy, and better prepared than our enemy, and we would still lose. Why? Because we have not fulfilled the conditions of victory. So Allah Azza wa Jal wants to purify us, wants to cleanse our ranks, and then after that we would win. وحينما نتحاكم إلى المقياس المادي في معركة ما ونعلق آمالنا بها فالهزيمة فيها ستحبط النفوس وتفت في الهمم وتعطل الجهاد. When we restrict our view of a particular battle to the material elements and then we lose, that would also weaken us. But we should always view that the issue is in the hands of Allah Azza wa Jal. If we win or if we lose, that is something that is in the control of Allah Azza wa Jal. As long as we do our part, that is what Allah will hold us accountable for. ولكن الصحيح أن نجاهد لأن الجهاد عبادة مفروضة سواء هزمنا أو انتصرنا. He said we have to fight jihad because it is fard on us. We're not fighting jihad to win or to lose. We're fighting jihad because we have to fight jihad. It's fard. In the end, he says, this should not be interpreted that I'm belittling the importance of the battle in Afghanistan, because again, this was written during the time of the initial phase of the American invasion of Afghanistan. He said, I'm not saying that our loss in Afghanistan doesn't mean anything. He said, no, that is an important issue. And if we lose in Afghanistan, that means that the enemy would be able to expand in our land. So he says it's important that we win. But the thing is that we have to do our part and then we leave the rest on Allah Azza wa Jalla. We have to do our part in terms of preparation and we have to do our part in terms of fulfilling the ibadah of jihad fi sabilillah. And then we make dua to Allah Azza wa Jalla. Just like Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, after he did everything that was humanly possible in the Battle of Badr. Financing the army, encouraging people to go out and fight, straightening the ranks, choosing the right location. He did everything that was possible. In the end, what did he do? He went aside and he started making dua to Allah. After you fulfill the means, then you leave it in the hands of Allah and you make sincere dua. And that is what we should do. We should follow the way of Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. So this is the end of the fourth principle. صلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم تسليما كثيرا